Welcome to the Continuing Education Podcast for CASA Volunteers, connecting you with experts who can advance your advocacy for children and families. I'm your host, Maggie Halpin, and this is CASA on the Go. Well, hi, everyone. I'm so glad to have you with us for today's conversation. It's one that I've really been looking forward to, and I feel very lucky to get to learn from the transformational work of our guest today. Liz Wendell, thank you so much for taking the time to share some of your work and insights with our network. You have done so many incredible things, and I would love to invite you to share a little bit about your background and the work you do before we dive in.
Sure. Thank you for having me. It's very exciting to be here, and always enjoy these conversations, so I've been looking forward to this. So let's see. It's always interesting to do an introduction yourself because there's so many, you know, I have the gift of having so many wonderful experiences and knowing so many people that I always struggle with where to start. But I think, you know, you and I were just talking about names, and that because my name is Elizabeth, I have people who call me Elizabeth and people who call me Liz and people who call me B, friends, family, colleagues, coworkers. And it's a little bit interesting to think about that in the context of an introduction because it's almost the different roles you hold in your life, right? I'm a daughter, a sister, a mother, a friend, a wife, a neighbor, a colleague. And I think all of those roles are shaped by maybe my first beginning interactions with social service work. Both of my parents did social service work. My sister does social service work. So I feel like it started maybe at a really young age, but I won't do my whole life. I'll just do some of the professional highlights that are kind of valuable to me and things I'm continuing to learn from right now. So I live in Philadelphia. I've lived here for what feels like forever, 25 years, and had the privilege of working in basically a preschool facility. That was my first job, working with children who had some sort of special needs diagnosis. And that was wonderful, but very early in that work, I found myself thinking about and questioning the systemic aspects of how service was delivered and how complicated it was. And I suspect that has contributed significantly to my lifelong, so far at least, obsession with how does this work, right? I know people who love to take things apart, right? Toasters or car engines. I'm more interested in taking apart processes and thinking, how does this actually work for people? Does it? Who defines help? Do the people on the receiving end feel it as help? What does that mean? So I think it probably started there. And so I worked there briefly, just a couple of years, got some wonderful experience, and then happened to be recruited into an organization, a nonprofit in Philadelphia that was starting this program called Family Finding. And I knew very little at the time. It was new to Philadelphia. And I was curious enough to say, yeah, let's talk and let's hear how it's going. And the background of the work was this person named Kevin Campbell had been working on family finding and developed this idea and had basically planted seeds all over the country and all over the world to question one very specific mechanism of child welfare, which is it true that kids have no one? We tell that story a lot. It's a very common narrative for young people in care, even small children. This kid has no one, but is it true? He asked. And that kind of gave way to his work and research and development of a practice framework called Family Finding that Philadelphia County had decided to pick up, which is how I found myself doing casework in the program. And so I got to meet Kevin. He came and trained our very small team of 2.5. We were responsible for the entire county of Philadelphia, so about 10,000 kids in care when I was there. So two caseworkers and a supervisor was a very small team, but again, a lot of ability to learn not only about the direct impact work and just have so many lessons and so many wonderful experiences with families, but also the sort of mechanics of the process and, you know, the city's way of thinking and policy and all of those things. And so I did that for a little while and then supervised that program and then eventually was the director of that program. And then fast forward quite a bit of time, last 5 years or so, Kevin and I had continued to connect and communicate, and he's continued to be a brilliant teacher for me, and I know many, many others, including people who are listening here probably. And he was starting some work in a different mechanical space, healthcare in the United States, U.S. healthcare and Medicaid specifically. And so I was invited to, alongside him, try and tackle some of that. And so that led me into the work that I do now, which is working alongside Kevin. We do all different kinds of things all over the world related to family finding and also what we now call family seeing, which I think we'll probably talk about today. And that's housed under our sort of organization, which is called Pale Blue Dot, which is I think a great name for what we're trying to capture and communicate in our work. We all live on this planet, referred by Carl Sagan as the Pale Blue Dot. And we couldn't think of a better way to try and wrap our arms around what we hope to do, which is just be in community with all of the people who live on this dot with us. And we owe it to each other, I think, to work at it and work together and be better and think about the planet and the people and the connection and the relationship that we have to one another and just kind of chip away at doing that as best we can every day. So that's the very short version of 20 years. And that's kind of where I am now and hopefully a good introduction.
Yeah, that's a beautiful introduction. Thank you, Liz. I'm feeling, as I was listening to you talk, especially about the work that y'all are doing at Pale Blue Dot right now, I was feeling such a sense of like home, like this planet is our home, and just how that feels so like immediately connected to me, to the work we do as child advocates around like wanting for families to like that all families deserve like a safe and loving home. And just how that, I don't know, just the interconnection of like, yeah, I think that's something that we all deserve. And that's our work together.
I love that you said all families, only kids, but their parents and grandparents and aunties and cousins and neighbors and teachers and foster parents and social workers, right? All families.
Yeah, all of us. Yeah. Well, you also mentioned the work that y'all have been doing in the healthcare system. And I'm really excited to talk to you about health because I feel like in the child welfare world, I hear people talk about safety and we talk about trauma and we talk about well-being and we talk about medical advocacy, but I really don't hear people talking about like health from this like broader perspective. And so could you talk about that connection, like, and how CASA advocates can bring this expanded view of health to their work walking alongside families?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to actually start with some language you used just a minute ago about the words we do tend to use. Safety being the big one, right? I think everyone who's worked in this industry for any short or long length of time has used and heard that word quite a bit. Safety is sort of the central line often for the social service world and particularly the child welfare world. And I think one of the challenges that we have to confront, and it's, I love this question because it's for us an intentional way to confront this. One of the things we have to confront is we often use these words that are so important and use them so much that they almost lose their value. They almost lose their expansiveness, their focus, right? If you sit right here with me right now and just think in general about the word safety. What does it mean? Right? What does it mean in your family? What does it mean when you're driving your car? What does it mean when you're getting your car inspected? What does it mean when you're learning something new or starting a new relationship? And in our space of child protection, we sometimes get boxed in to safety. Is this child physically safe? Are they getting their basic needs met? Okay, then they're safe. What about emotional safety? What about relational safety? What about health safety? I think it's important to think about all of that and just push ourselves to be expansive. And you could do that with any word, right? Connection, love, belonging, support, all of them, right? We just have to continue to fight. I think the sort of, it's almost pushed into us or coached into us this binary, this means one thing and one thing only idea, whatever the word is. And so I start there because I think the health piece of the work that we do and the information that we often find ourselves talking about and sharing is one of the ways that we are intentional about being expansive about these ideas of safety or belonging or well-being. If you sit with most folks who are doing this kind of work, I think the intention is good. And, you know, I hope we are all pushing to continue to be expansive, even in our own minds, and health data is one way to do that. I will say particularly about this health data from the first of this came out in 2020. So it's not that old. And it takes our particular industry sometimes a while to kind of wrap our arms around new things. And there were some other things happening in the world in 2020 when this data was originally released. And so I imagine that's part of it. But we found some real success in the novelty of thinking about a health trajectory for a young person or a parent, because it's new, right? Because it's different, because it's data we just didn't have 20 years ago. It's kind of fascinating. So I mentioned we do this work in the healthcare world. I think the data that I've been referencing repeatedly over the last couple of minutes is worth just taking a minute to share because it's important. It's a little bit painful, I think, for those of us who've worked in this space for a long time, because it points at some of the things that we just didn't know. But we always try to remind folks when we're learning something new, there may be grief, but for us, it's really a different G word. It's growth. When you understand things or learn things that you once did not know, it's just growth. And if you're doing that fairly constantly and consistently, what a gift that is. And this data would be no exception. So this is what we call metadata. It's data that's been replicated and shared all over the planet at this point. But I'm going to specifically talk today about the UK data, and I'll be happy to share the link directly to this so that you can put it in your show notes or wherever you like. But this is UK data that looked at what we call longitudinal health trajectory. So longitudinal meaning over a long period of time. The first cohort of data was collected way back in 1971, most recent to 2021. So if you do the math, they're going by decades here. And essentially what they're trying to look at and connect in this particular research is what the trajectory, so what the line is between some of the living arrangement experiences that young people have and their health 10, 20, and 30 years later. So this is research done in partnership between King's College London and University College London. And researches young people with care experience who have progressed into adulthood. And I'll talk about the mortality data as well. So the first piece of this is particular to adults who lived at any point in what we would call stranger foster care here in the United States or residential group care. So those two cohorts of young people by the decade following their exit from care, so approximately 29, 30, 31 years old, those people had a chance, a 40% chance of reporting very poor health. Now, let me contextualize this for us because we are in the United States, and so there is some language difference from the UK to the US. The UK would say very poor health. We would say at least one chronic disease or condition. So something that this group of people is going to live with for the rest of their life. So just think about that for a second. 40% chance of reporting at least one, sometimes many, right? We call that comorbidity, chronic disease or condition in the decade following their exit from care. So these are things like heart disease, diabetes, autoimmune disorders, cardiovascular disorders, but also some that we would categorize in sort of a mental or behavioral health context. So physical health, but also emotional, social health diagnoses often. This 40% jumps to 85% chance if you go two more decades ahead. So for people in their basically midpoint of life, 50s to 60s, 85% of people are reporting at least one chronic disease or condition. And remember, these are adults who lived in foster group or residential care at some point in their childhood. So that's pretty significant. Next piece changes just one bit of context, which is instead of group or residential or foster care, children who grew up with a relative, so didn't live permanently with a biological parent, but instead lived in what we would call here in the United States a kinship arrangement, 10 years after, so 10 years into formal adulthood, basically, the chance of reporting a chronic disease or condition is just 21% and jumps to 43% over the next 30 years. So approximately age 30, 21% of people are reporting a very significant chronic disease or condition, 43% likelihood by the time you're kind of in your midpoint of life. Here's the interesting one. Adults who grew up with parents. So this could be, there's a couple different categories here. Both parents with one parent, or in some situations, moved from one parent to the other parent during their childhood. In the United States, we sometimes call this a move to a non-offending parent, which is a reference to our sort of punitive adult system. But essentially, that would be one of these categories, is a kid who lived with a mom and then moved to live with a dad during their childhood. That would still count as living with parents. So that group of people as adults, 13% chance of reporting a chronic disease or condition 10 years later, and that goes to just 21% in the following two decades. So midpoint of life, you're at 21%. This is fairly consistent with the general population, by the way, right? So if you look at kind of population health data for chronic disease or conditions, very similar. I think what's powerful for us about this is it's really important to differentiate between correlation and causation, right? They talk about that in this research, but you can see some lines, right? You can see some pretty intensive connections that we just didn't have before. And I think for us, what it points to is we're not by any means arguing or trying to use this evidence to argue that people don't have adversity in their home of origin, right? That's not what we're saying. We're just saying it's both, right? It's an accumulation. It's a composition of the adversity that young people are experiencing into adulthoods. And we now know from a very sort of simple biological or scientific perspective, the health consequences of that. And I think that's some evidence that we can stand on differently for how we might respond, how folks listening as advocates might be thinking about just the process or the order of operations for decision-making. You know, just add a layer of consideration. What's this young person's health look like in 20 years if they live in a relational desert as a child? What does their health look like if they have had some really significant adversity experiences, but are completely surrounded and supported by the best medicine we have, which is our relationships? You're going to have two very different health trajectories there. It's an interesting way to think about it, and I think could have some real impact on how we respond based on longer term consequences for people's health.
Yeah, that is incredibly powerful information to just pause and think about what that means for anyone who is working with parents and their children. And I'm thinking about like one of the principles of your work being that parenting is health. And that parenting is safety. We were talking about like, well, what, you know, safety, yeah, what does that mean? It does have a really specific way of being understood typically in child welfare. And I understand the reasons for that, but I am just wholeheartedly with you that it can't be only that. We have to zoom out and see what makes children feel safe. And if they're cut off from the relationships that sustain them, that like, what are we going to do about that? And like, how are we trying to prevent that? So, and just thinking too that, you know, working in a system where today it seems that so many of like experts on child welfare practice today strongly agree that, or many, I would say, like strongly agree that the wisdom and the voices and experiences and leadership of parents is not taken seriously enough when it comes to the health and well-being of their children. And so as someone who brings this system-wide perspective, as well as so much experience working, you know, hand in hand with families, do you have thoughts with Liz about how CASA advocates can work to like lift up the urgent interconnectedness of parenting and health?
That's a really big question, but yes, let me take a shot. I let me start with the simple piece, because I think we talked about this at the beginning and you've just done it so beautifully. How often do we even utter the word parent? Right? I often hear people talking about young people, children, families. Many systems call themselves some version of children and families. Where are parents in that? Where is the word parents in that? And I don't mean to make a blanket statement in reverse either, right? I know and have the privilege of knowing a lot of people who are absolutely parents themselves, parent allies, would just absolutely stand firm that parents are central in this conversation. That's certainly true for me. I think where we have an opportunity is to understand some of the complexities and consequences of relational health or relational disconnection, specifically in the relationship between parents and parents and their children. You're absolutely spot on in my mind that parents are experts in life, the world, and their children. And we take that away from them sometimes. And I don't think we can have this part of the conversation without, at least as a beginning, this is probably another many hours of conversation, but at least an acknowledgement of the race equity layer of that for parents who are involved with child protection in your state and all of the others and in other places in the world, by the way. I think one of the ways that I sometimes start to try and break that down in my own mind is to examine it in the context of the larger history of the country that we live in, the relationships that we have between different groups economically, in terms of race, in terms of geography, gender, you take your pick. But certainly the we know some, you know, the data speaks for itself here about the representation implications related to parents in child welfare in the United States. I think the piece that sticks out for me the most about your question in terms of what do we do, right? You're thinking action. So we know some things, but what do we do about it? It'd be interesting to think about what happened if all of the adults who have chosen to spend their lives doing this work had the opportunity to be in partnership with parents instead of opposition to parents. Sometimes we find ourselves positioned there. And so I think we have to make an intentional choice about pushing against that, fighting against that. I've certainly had conversations with parents over the years where it feels surprising that a social worker or a social service person is actually interested in their knowledge and expertise and their primary position as the parent. And so that's a simple actionable thing, I think, is how do you want to start your relationship? The first time you're interacting with a family and parents within that family, how do you want to be seen in that relationship? How do you want to be received in that relationship, which is something we can do, right? I want to be seen in a particular way every time I interact with a new person, particularly a parent. Same for young people, by the way. But how do you want to be seen? And what happens if every time for the next 2 weeks of your life that you're going to interact with a new person, you ask that question in the car on the way? What happens? What changes? Maybe it's a little experiment to do and see for yourself. What might shift for you? You know, what are you carrying into those conversations? What are you willing to set down for those conversations? What might you learn about yourself or about the people that you get to work with? So that's a simple one. Obviously, there are systemic ways to think about this also. And I think we've got a real reckoning happening in our part of the world right now around that. So I'm glad for that. I hope that will continue to push us forward. But I think we've got to stop ignoring the thing you started with, which is parents are the experts here. Parents are health. Parenting is health. There's a biology to that relationship that we must not avoid and must not ignore and must not break down and make insignificant. It just doesn't make sense biologically. And because I know this will come up, because I've had this conversation many times, even in the last week, there's always the what about isms, right? So particularly when we talk about parents, I often get people saying, well, what about this situation? What about that situation? What about parents who harm their children? And my response is always the same, and I'm going to be reductive and simplistic here in the interest of time, but what about them? Do you want to be seen differently based on what type of person you think it is? No, probably not. Do people who get labeled and reduced and made into objects benefit from that? No. It's incredibly harmful. What if we were more intentional about that, even for people who, and I'm going to use my sort of way of thinking about this here, even people who are so distressed for so long that something has led to it feeling reasonable to cause harm in some way to a child or another person. Do those people not deserve just as much love, support, compassion, connection as everyone else? I'm not condoning people hurting each other or hurting children or their children. I'm not condoning that at all. But I do think we have to challenge ourselves a little bit and ask who decides who's deserving of love and who's not. And if we don't deal with that, we're going to continue to have some of the problems I think we have in the world.
You put that so eloquently and so powerfully, and it is reminding me of, I think, in the CASA movement sometimes, especially historically, there was this idea of, like, I think about it as, like, turning towards suffering. And I think historically there was this idea of, like, where people came because they wanted to turn toward the suffering of children in their community. And like you said earlier, like, that's a beautiful intention. And I think what we've, the lesson we have to, like, learn and practice today, because now we know, and when we know better, we can do better, is we can't turn, like, we have to turn toward the suffering of parents and their children and of families if we really want to, be part of, like, long-term healing. Because having the idea that that children exist, like, in a vacuum or need to be, like, just saved from their families is really harmful. And now we know that. And I think the information you're bringing forward from a health perspective is another way of bearing witness to that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely agree with that. And I think the other piece for me that's so, it's so simple, but I've got it literally on a post-it on the left of my desk here. And it just says parents were kids once. Parents were kids once. I think you're right. If you look at the history of child protection, even in the name, right, it's child protection. We can argue the semantics of the language and whether it's accurate or not at some other point, but it is child-centered, right? It's been that way for a long time, and that's wonderful. I'm glad we think about kids. Kids are amazing, and we should be in support and solidarity of them. And why not their parents and grandparents and aunties? But I always start with parents. Why not their parents, who were also children once? I sometimes do an exercise around, I won't go into it, but just telling a story about a young person and their care experience, and then their child and their care experience. And it's essentially the same story, right? It's what we would call intergenerational. It just repeats. And yet we hold this particular parent in such a negative light. And we judge her and we say all these awful things about her and not her child, which I'm glad for, but why her? Why do we do that to her? She was a kid once. At what point did we expect there was going to be some magic developmental switch flipped where she would know it all, where she would have gotten what she needed and gotten the healing from her relationships to just magically be perfect? By the way, who among us is a perfect parent? I'm just saying. But yeah, I think we've got to expand our reach, and rather than try and reach around and hold somebody as if we're the healing mechanism, just reach out and hold the hand of the person next to us and think about what healing means for them together with their people.
Yeah. And that is like one of my hopes for the CASA, for CASA organizations and individuals involved in working with CASA, is that we can be like part of working for healing. And could you talk about, like, are there, you were saying earlier, I thought it was really, really compelling and helpful how you're saying, what if when you're driving to meet this parent, you're asking yourself, how do I want to be seen by this person? And really like grounding in that intention for how we're showing up in that relationship. And I would love to hear, like, do you feel like there's questions we could be asking ourselves in our work with young people, with kids and youth and parents, to help bring a commitment to healing into the center of our relationships and the center of our advocacy?
Yes, thousands of questions, but well, let me see if I can draw out a few. I think the first one I've already offered is a big one in my work, in my practice. How do I want to be seen? Right? How do I want to show up in this space, in this conversation, in this introduction? Right? We are, by sort of design, encountering people in some of the scariest, hardest, most painful moments of their lives. How do you want to show up in that with somebody? I mentioned when we were getting started here that I had just come off another conversation about a particular parent and child in another part of the States, and I found myself, as I was listening to the sort of description of what had been happening, I found myself thinking, this person, this parent, has had a lot of practice at protecting herself from this system that's meant to help, but doesn't, isn't, in her case, is not, absolutely not. I'm going to just be unequivocal about that. I wonder what happens if the first thing the next person says to her is, I'm sorry. Saying I'm sorry for me sometimes means taking personal responsibility. I think we need to do that sometimes. But certainly some of the things unfold, right? I didn't design the system personally. But it doesn't mean I don't participate. It doesn't mean her experience hasn't been what it's been. It doesn't mean I don't want to start the relationship in a really specific way by saying, I'm sorry for what's happened to you. Or I'm sorry for my part in that. Or I'm sorry because I don't know what to do here. But I hope you and I can think about it together. And that's what I can offer. And that's what I hope you will see. Is I'm going to sit with you and be with you and learn from you and figure it out with you as best I possibly can with the resources that I have. So that's one. Some other big ones that come to mind are, what is healing and whose is it? I think one of the other sort of traps, quicksand traps that we might fall into is assuming that we are the only people who could possibly heal someone. And I don't know that that's accurate. I think people heal in the context of their relationships, including sometimes relationships where the trauma happened. I think people heal in the context of time, new experiences. We can catalyze that, facilitate that, convene people around that idea. But I think it's an immense amount of mis-situated pressure to assume we are healers all the time. Doesn't mean we don't contribute. But I just, that's a big one for me. Maybe the third one that I've been, I get kind of obsessed with ideas sometimes, and I've been obsessed with this one for a couple months. What do I want to remember? And here's what I mean by that. We have continued to evolve into an incredibly complex system, but also an incredibly complex world. I was reading last night, for example, some research about how much information we have access to immediately, right? You can go online and know what's happening in many parts of the world, at least as best as the media tells you, at the click of a button, right? But we're inundated all the time, and we're not built for that, right? If you look kind of back anthropologically, we knew what was happening in our neighborhood, our community, our tribe, our family, but not on the other side of the world, which doesn't mean don't pay attention to the world. Absolutely not. It's really valuable to be connected in that way. But we can only manage so much of that before we numb and shut down and all of these things. And I think we do that in our work. And so when I say, what do I want to remember? I mean, very specifically, are there things that I once knew personally, or that I as a human in my DNA once knew, or people before me knew, that's actually really valuable to the simple purpose of why to be together? Right? You said this a little bit ago about parents. We know that children's relationships and access to relationships with their parents have a biological implication, a health implication, a behavioral implication, an emotional implication. We know that. We've known that for a long time. My great grandma knew that. The community, you know, we get to work with some Aboriginal and Indigenous communities in various parts of the world. This is not new. It's old. But we are very distracted, and so we forget. And so what do you want to remember, and how does that help you keep it simple and keep focused about your positioning in all of it? So those are three questions. There are many others, but I think in reality, probably the most valuable thing for each of us is to find our own questions. You know, what helps you hold your focus? What helps you hold your clarity on your position in the help or the support or the relationship? And whatever questions those are for each of you, use them.
Liz, thank you so much. This has been such a rich conversation. And I'm so grateful to you for the work you do and for taking the time to share some of the insights and gifts from that work with us. Feeling a lot of gratitude, just such a joy to get to connect with you. Thank you.
No, thank you for having me. I love the opportunity to just slow down and think about this once in a while, right? It's a really valuable gift that we have as complex people. So I'm glad for the opportunity. Thank you for facilitating it and the work that you're doing. It's really a privilege.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to CASA On The Go. Join us next time for more dynamic continuing education brought to you by Texas CASA.